Before we kick off the show, if you're a fan of History Hack, please do what you can to support the show. We completely get that not everyone is able or willing to dig into their pockets. Times are hard, but by dropping a like, subscribing on Twitter and YouTube, and importantly, leaving a review wherever you get your podcasts, you can help the program grow and reach more people. If you're interested in becoming a supporter, go to patreon.com/historyhack, where you'll find perks from secret Facebook groups to early release material. If you just want to leave us a one-off tip, go to ko-fi.com/historyhack. The links are in the description. And whatever form your kind support takes, know that we are massively grateful. Enjoy the show.
Hello and welcome to another episode of History Hack. We're going medieval today, and to do so, we have Hilary Green with us. He's a graduate of Liverpool and Liverpool John Moores Universities, author of several historical novels, including the Folly series and The Last Hero. She's here today to talk about international trade in the Middle Ages. Hilary, welcome.
Thank you.
This is such a massive topic. Where should we start? Should we start with money? During this period, how does it work? I mean, obviously you have different currencies in different countries. The currency is based upon precious metal, isn't it? Which leads to all kinds of concerns about things like coin clipping.
Well, that's right. It is based upon silver and gold. And I think the way it worked was that if the silver was pure, if it was assayed and tested, I've lost you. What's happened?
No, it's okay. I'm still here.
Oh, I've just got a blank screen now. As long as the weight was right and it was proved that the metal was pure, then I don't think it mattered which mint had issued it or whose head was on the back of the coin. It was all about the weight of silver or the weight of gold.
Okay, so how does money work during this period then?
Well, initially, of course, it was a question of merchants carrying large bags of silver or gold around with them. But as trade became established, this obviously wasn't very practical. And what happened was that at the great trade fairs in Europe, people, usually the Jews, set up what they called their banks, their benches. And they then would offer letters of credit, which could be exchanged at either end of the journey, so that people didn't have to carry large quantities of gold or silver around with them. But it did cause a problem when they were dealing with outside of Europe, because the countries in the Middle East and the Arab countries insisted on being paid in gold. And that meant that by the end of the 15th century, there was actually a bullion famine, because so much gold and silver was going out of Europe to the Arab countries. And of course, it wasn't coming back. It was coming back in the form of spices and silks, but that's not currency. So some of the silver mines were beginning to run down. People hadn't got the technology to mine deep enough. And for quite a while, there was a terrible shortage of currency and trade really suffered. But then new methods of mining were discovered, pumps to pump out water so that they could mine deeper, different ways of separating the silver from the other impurities in the ore. And that increased the supply of silver and trade picked up again.
How much, you've just mentioned the Middle East as well. So I've just got back from the Middle East. Everything still is about bartering there. How much has bartering come into play with medieval trade?
Not at all, as far as I can make out. I mean, obviously locally between members of the same village or close by, that could be barter. But the big trading companies were purely working on money transactions.
I think it'd be interesting for our listeners to sort of get parachuted into a medieval market. So what would the sights and sounds have been like? What would it have been like to experience attending one?
For example, in the early years, the great markets were in the area of Champagne in France, because it was an area which had good communications, particularly by river. Most trade travelled by water. It was too risky to take it overland most of the time. And also, the Counts of Champagne were very aware of the advantage of trade, so they protected the trade fairs. So if you went to one of the great trade fairs at Troyes, for example, you would find furs from Russia, marten skins from Ireland, tin from Cornwall, fine textiles from Flanders, spices from the Middle East, with things like pepper and cinnamon and nutmeg and silk. But in those days, they were traded there, but nobody knew where they actually came from. It was a complete mystery. But you could find all those things, and you could find things like horses, birds of prey, all sorts of things were traded. It was a real melee of anything you could possibly want to lay your hands on.
And how long would one of these trade fairs last?
They usually lasted a few weeks, and there would be 1 week for, say, edible goods, and 1 week for textiles, and 1 week for leather goods, and that kind of thing. And different merchants would come and set up their stalls and bring their goods, and then people would come from all over to buy and take them away.
And what are the most common things that people trade in? Wool springs to mind as an obvious one.
Well, wool was the great export from England.
Yeah.
English finances really were founded on wool. The wool sheared from sheep in the great monastic lands in the north of the country, in Yorkshire and around there, was better quality than the wool you got from, say, Spanish sheep. And the weavers of Flanders had to have that top quality wool in order to make the very high quality textiles that they were experts in. So wool certainly was the most important thing as far as Britain went. It's interesting to think, in fact, so many little sayings we have are referring to the wool trade, things like being fleeced or having the wool pulled over your eyes. A spinster is a woman who uses a spinning wheel to spin wool. A lot of our sort of common sayings come back to that period. And of course, the taxes on wool financed the wars in France, financed Edward III's wars. He taxed wool very heavily to finance his wars. So that was the most important thing from this country. But then, as I say, there were all these other things. The Hanseatic League, which traded in Northern Europe, they would bring furs all the way from Russia. And then you've got basic things like salt and sugar, of course, which were traded. You name it, they traded in it, really. Precious jewels, ivory, elephant ivory, all these things were traded backwards and forwards.
The rewards could have been massive, I suppose, for a merchant at this period, but you mentioned about moving things by water because it wasn't safe over land. I mean, is it a dangerous profession?
Oh, it was, very much so. I mean, if you travelled overland, there were bandits. Travelling by sea, there were pirates. And also, the different countries, particularly cities like Venice and Genoa, were constantly at war with each other over trade. So apart from the general hazards of sickness and getting lost or storms and tempests, traveling anywhere in Europe and in the Middle East was a very hazardous business in those days.
Are there any famous merchants that spring to mind that have left sort of stories of how dangerous it was?
Well, I suppose the most famous one is Marco Polo, who went all the way to China. It's been disputed whether he did actually get there all the way, but recent scholarship suggests that yes, he did. And that was a very perilous journey. And we talk about the Silk Road.
Yeah.
But it wasn't a road as such. It was a series of routes from one oasis to the next oasis. And nobody normally would travel the whole distance. Merchants would bring goods, say, from China to the first oasis, and then they would trade them for something else, and they'd be traded on to the next oasis, and on until eventually they arrived somewhere like Constantinople. But it wasn't a well-organized route, although certain potentates did take a great deal of trouble to protect it. Genghis Khan, for example, went to a lot of trouble to set up inns for travellers to stay in, to make sure they were protected, to pass laws saying that anybody who harmed them would suffer for it. And they realised the value of trade. But even so, it was a hazardous business. And as I say, Marco Polo was probably, he and his colleagues were probably the only people who actually did the whole journey.
Are there big trading hubs? Are there cities that come in and out of fashion during the Middle Ages as different goods become more or less fashionable?
Yes, that's true. Hmm. I mean, as I said earlier, the great trading fairs in Troyes and Provence and Champagne were the first ones. But then, of course, Venice became extremely important, and Genoa, and to a less degree, cities like Amalfi and Pisa. They were the people who traded with the Arab nations. They would go to Alexandria, or to Jerusalem, or to Tyre and Sidon. And they had what were called funduks, a kind of warehouse and accommodation which they would set up in these foreign places. And there they would bargain with the traders coming in from the Red Sea, and would buy the spices and the frankincense and the myrrh, or if they were on maybe in Antioch, they would buy silk coming through from China.
You mentioned Flanders as well. Personally spend a lot of time in Ypres, and of course the cloth hall was rebuilt after the First World War, but that was a massive centre at certain points in the Middle Ages, wasn't it?
It certainly was a centre particularly of making textiles. It was very, very important in that area. Yes, if you went to Bruges, for example, you could buy practically anything you could possibly want. I mean, even things like oranges, although they wouldn't be the sweet oranges that we know now. They would have been bitter oranges. But, you know, really exotic things would be brought there. In exchange for the fabulous textiles they made. I mean, beautiful tapestries, woolen goods, all sorts of woven goods, which were very, very well thought of and much sought after.
You've mentioned as well, of course, the Silk Road going all the way to China and that. I'm guessing trading networks would have spread the entire length and breadth of the known world. Do we see people going backwards and forwards from sub-Saharan Africa as well, for instance?
Yes, we did. A lot of gold, most of the gold came from Africa. Mansa Musa, the king of Timbuktu, was the richest man in the world because he had unlimited supplies of gold. And when he went on Hajj to visit Mecca, he spent so much gold in Egypt that the currency collapsed. And he had to borrow a lot of it back at a high rate of interest. So, yes, certainly gold from Africa and slaves. That was another trade. Christians weren't supposed to own slaves, but it was okay as long as they were not Christian. But most Christian societies didn't go in for saving, but they certainly bought slaves and sold them on to the Arab countries and the Muslim countries, which did employ slaves. So that was another big element.
I'm just still curious about the King of Timbuktu. Do we know what he was buying in Egypt to have spent so much gold?
I don't think he was buying exactly. He was just, he had an enormous train of people with him, all dressed up to the nines. And he was supporting all these people, buying food for them. And he was also extremely charitable. He was building mosques everywhere he went. So that's where the money was going.
Okay, so there's just such an influx of his gold into the market that the whole thing falls down.
That's right.
Wow, that is some amount of money, isn't it? He sounds like a traitor as well.
Yes, it's an amazing story.
I mean, we've talked about everything, sadly, from human beings to furs to gold. Do we see an exchange of ideas coming along as well?
I think that is the most fascinating part of it.
Yeah, I'm thinking as well of the library in Alexandria with the swapping of the books through traders coming in.
Well, that's right. I mean, at that period in history, medieval Europe was very backward in all sorts of areas of intellectual life because the Christian church thought that the knowledge of the Greeks, for example, was pagan knowledge and therefore shouldn't be propagated. So medieval Europe had completely lost touch with the classical knowledge, whereas in Constantinople, where although it was a Roman city, the language was Greek. So they kept all this work by people like Aristotle and Plato. They were known there and were copied and passed on. And then when the great civilizations of Persia and Egypt came into being, they sent scholars to Constantinople to collect these documents and translate them into Arabic. And that's how they were all in the great libraries like the Library of Alexandria. And it was when European merchants made contact with that civilization, they then began to understand some of this work. I mean, they were so far ahead of us. I mean, the grandson of Tamburlaine the Great set up an observatory, and they were able to calculate the length of the year to within a few seconds of what we call it, what we would agree to now. And the medicine was very advanced. People like, he was known as Avicenna in the West. His books about medicine were really the basis of all European medicine until about the 17th century.
It's outstanding, isn't it? Other than medicine and sort of, do we also see the spread of Islam as well? I'm thinking as well of Spain becoming
yes, of course,
Islamic, southern Spain.
A large part of Spain was conquered and was Islamic, and that was another source of information for scholars from northern Europe, because they could go to southern Spain and find all these documents, these important writings about medicine and various subjects. They could find them there and translate them back into Latin.
I just find, like you say, it is perhaps the most fascinating aspect as well. Do we see any, I mean, I'm guessing gunpowder as well is another one, is it?
That is the connection with China.
Yeah.
It wasn't just silk. Yes, gunpowder, they initially produced it for making fireworks, of course, but it was soon adapted to use in warfare. Printing.
Yep.
The first printing came from China, and paper itself, of course, was a Chinese invention. And the Chinese had books. A well-read Chinese person was supposed to have, I think, something like 100 books in his library, which was amazing in those days. And of course, they had to be written on wooden slats or reeds. So they were very cumbersome until the invention of paper came in. And then they were able to increase the number of books they produced enormously. But that certainly that whole idea came originally from China.
Do we see... Oh, sorry, go on.
I was going to say they invented things like the trebuchet for warfare, you know, the sort of catapult that would deliver rocks against the walls of a fortress. That was a Chinese invention originally.
Do we see Western ideas going east as well?
Yes, certainly cultural ideas and religious ideas. Mm. Obviously, Christian people went to China and tried to set up Christian churches there. They were quite well prepared to accept, in those days, different religions. People, you know, Muslims, Christians, Buddhists, were all travelling backwards and forwards along those routes, disseminating their ideas.
It's just fascinating, isn't it? If you could put yourself into the Middle Ages anywhere and have a look, where would you have gone?
Oh, I think I'd go to Venice.
Yeah.
Venice was absolutely at the hub of all this, and it was such a vibrant society. Different influences coming in from Europe, from Asia, from Africa. It must have been an incredible place to be.
Absolutely. I think as well, just the colour and the vibrancy of it all.
That's right. Yes, the beautiful buildings. And mind you, a lot of those are a bit later than medieval. Mm. But yes, it was a vibrant society, undoubtedly.
All of the stuff that we've been talking about is sort of pre-imperial, isn't it? But trade has a lot to do with what comes next, as in the growth of empire. How does that come about?
Well, of course, the Portuguese had a lot to do with it initially, because they were the people who were the great navigators. They found the way around the Cape of Good Hope and established sea routes to the Far East, where people, Europeans, had not been before. But then when Europeans, Northern Europeans, realised the tremendous wealth there was in places like the Moluccas and India and Ceylon and those areas, they wanted to have their share of it. And there was some there was warfare between the Dutch and the Portuguese for the right to trade in that area. And the Dutch eventually won. And then they set up the Dutch East Indies Company. And at the same time, the Brits saw that they weren't going, didn't want to miss out on that. So you get people going to petition Queen Elizabeth for permission to go and set up trading enclaves in India. And of course, that's the beginning of the British East India Company. And then, of course, at the end of the period, you get Columbus sailing to America, and the whole pattern of trade all around the world changes radically from that day on.
What are the major differences that we see? Because obviously we see a decline in city-states like Venice and Genoa, don't we?
Yes, power tended to shift northwards then, because people who had access to the Atlantic and the trade coming in from South America. Spain, of course, initially became immensely wealthy, and then other people got in on the act, as it were, and the balance of power does then start moving northwards. to places like Frankfurt was extremely important. Of course, London was always a great trading city. And the people, wealth coming in from countries like, from companies like the East India Company, brought tremendous prosperity to London and to England. And same sort of thing was going on in Holland.
I think as well, we assume that things like Britain's obsession with curry comes from the 1960s, but that's not true, is it?
Well, of course, people were absolutely, they loved the spices that were coming in. I mean, pepper, a pound of pepper weighed more, was worth more than a pound of gold. And they thought it had almost magical properties, certainly medicinal properties. And all these other spices, a lot of, the, of it came back with the Crusaders, of course. They had gone to Jerusalem and they'd been in the Middle East and they'd been in Constantinople and they'd experienced dishes flavoured with all these exotic substances. And then when they came home again, they brought with them cooks who could replicate that. And it was a great sort of a prestige thing to have all these various spicy dishes. If you were giving a big feast, that you had to have all these elaborate sauces with different spices in them, just to prove that you could afford to buy them.
And one thing that springs to mind, certainly just like in Henry VIII's time, I vaguely remember this from going around Hampton Court kitchens, is that they're preservatives as well, isn't there? So before refrigeration, spices are what keeps your food fresher for longer.
Yes. They helped, but of course, the real thing there was salt.
Yeah.
And that was another big trading item. Salt roads grew up all over Europe, running from the places where salt was produced to places which didn't have salt. From, for example, from Venice around Chioggia, they had salt pans there, and salt was traded from there. The Genoese traded it from Ibiza. There were salt roads that went right up into Northern Europe where there were salt areas where you could mine salt. So that was very valuable. And that really was the most important thing for preserving food, you know, fish in barrels of salt, that kind of thing.
Hilary, this has been absolutely fascinating. Thank you so much. Your book, International Trade in the Middle Ages, is out now. You can get it on the History Hack bookstore, by which, of course, you bypass Amazon. You don't give Jeff Bezos money for rocket fuel. Instead, the money goes to local booksellers and Hilary, and a bit to us as well. Hilary, thank you so much.
Not at all. Thank you very much for hosting me.
When our guests join us to talk about their work and their new book, the 45 minutes or so they spend with us is just a taster of all their efforts. So to this end, we have launched our very own bookshop on bookshop.org, where you can find our guests' latest and greatest books. You can support them and you can support History Hack too. 10% of every sale via our bookshop supports the podcast and allows us to keep at it and bring you more amazing guests. You can find our bookshop at bookshop.org/shop/History Hack, or just search on bookshop.org for us under the shops bit. Thank you for your continued support, and here's to your next great book.